For this morning's talk on meditation, I wanted to discuss an important aspect of meditation, one you should be aware of, that is the five hindrances. They're called hindrances because they obstruct not only wisdom arising in the mind, but they obstruct the mind becoming peaceful and concentrated. They cause disturbances in the mind. And as such, that if there is any obstacle to one's success in meditation, one can also attribute it to one or more of the five hindrances being present and disturbing the mind. And very often, if one knows exactly what's going on, what the disturbance is, what the obstacle is, and one can identify it as being one of the hindrances, then one can find an antidote to that obstruction and solve the problem. So very often it's very useful if one is having a problem in one's meditation or a hurdle, then to see if you can identify it in terms of the hindrances and then apply the appropriate solution. And those five hindrances, which many of you will know, the first one is it's got two names in Pali, Kamachanda and Abhijja. It means the desire centered on the world of the five senses. That which we call karma, K-long-A-M-A, is the word designated by the Buddha to refer to all that is connected with the senses of sight, hearing, touch, taste and smell. And the first thing I'll point out here that the five hindrances, sense desire is sometimes called, but please remember that does not include the desire connected with the sixth sense, the mind. That first hindrance of sense desire does not include the aspiration to enjoy the pleasures, the happiness of the jhanas. And it's an important point to notice this, because you see that that desire for the happiness of the mind, of the jhanas, is deliberately left out of the hindrances. Now, one needs that desire in order to attain the goal. However, one should be careful that one is eradicating or letting go of, avoiding the arising of the happinesses of the realm of the five senses. The second hindrance is ill will. Ill will is that hatred, the wanting to destroy, the negativity, the being upset. It is usually described as being ill will towards a living being. However, it can be ill will towards any object, even objects of the mind, even like ill will towards the breathing, to the object which you're trying to concentrate on. And again, I will mention that in more full in a moment. And the third hindrance is the tinamida, which is the sloth and torpor, which many of you will be familiar with when you first get up in the morning. And you can see that that's an obstacle to the brightness of the mind, the clarity of the mind. And that is an obstacle to the meditation we need to notice and need to do something about. The udacca kukacca, which is the restlessness and remorse. It's interesting that these two are put together, restlessness and remorse, because remorse is specifically related to some sense of guilt, some sense of shame about some act one has done in the past which was bad karma, immoral, hurtful, harmful. And it's a strange thing that the human being, if they do an act like that, they think about it. And it occupies the mind and creates a lot of disturbance to the mind. It's the bad effect in the mind of unwholesome, unskillful acts of karma. And that's associated with just general restlessness of the mind. A mind who has too much energy, the energy is unbalanced and produces the disturbance of the mind. The mind which has not settled inside of itself but it's going around thinking about this, thinking about that. That restlessness is very commonly intertwined with the first hindrance of Karmachanda, because it is because of that desire for satisfaction in the sensory world the mind goes wandering off here, wandering off there, thinking about this, looking for that, and that causes the restlessness in the mind. And the restlessness, you will know, it's an easy hindrance to pick up. And the last of the hindrances is uchikicca, is doubt. And as I was mentioning the other day, that doubt can be in many areas. It can be doubt about the teaching, it can be doubt about the method, it can be doubt about the teacher, and especially it can be doubt about oneself, whether one has what it takes to achieve these states of mind. Once there is doubt there, it is a hindrance, and it will be an obstacle for your attaining. You know that the degree of faith and what faith can achieve, if you think you can do it, you've overcome the doubt, and very often you do it. Just the power of belief, the power of faith is extremely strong. So those are the five hindrances in brief. Now let's look at them in a bit more detail. The first hindrance of Karmachanda or Abhijja, which is the work of the mind which is devoted to finding satisfaction or pleasure in the sensory realm. It's usually manifested as just plain old sensory desire. In one's meditation, it's either thinking sexual fantasies, delights of the past, thinking about what you can have for lunch today. That is the more grosser form of the sensual desire. What it does is it takes the mind away from its source, out into the world. It also includes the thoughts connected with attaining those goals of sensory satisfaction. You know, how are you going to do it? Planning. What are you going to do? And that even gets to be as subtle things as thinking about the renovations in your monastery, thinking about the painting job you have to do in your house, thinking about the clothes you're going to buy, thinking about the holiday you're going to go on, thinking about the plants you're going to put in your garden. These are all concerned with trying to find some satisfaction, some pleasure in the world of the five senses. And I'm mentioning it's not just pleasure, but even like satisfaction or comfort is included here as under Karmachanda, the first hindrance. Even like seeking to find pleasure or seeking to find comfort in this world is included under this hindrance. And it's very well manifest in the fifth of the senses, being the sense of touch, the physical sensation. You can see how the search, the demand for comfort in the bodily sense does create an awful lot of disturbance when one is trying to meditate. The body itches, the body aches, it's too hot, it's too cold, the wind is too strong, or the wind is not strong enough. There's a fly on you, there's a mosquito on you. The bodily disturbances are very strong, and a lot of the time we don't look upon this as a search for pleasure. In that sense, we look upon it as just trying to get rid of disturbances, but this is still in the realm of trying to find comfort, satisfaction in the realm of the five external senses. And you should know by your experience that trying to overcome that hindrance by getting into the perfect posture, by scratching all the itches, by finding the perfect climate or the room with the perfect air conditioner, with the perfect fly screens, that is impossible. That no matter how you put your body, no matter what posture, no matter how many cushions you sit on, no matter how much of the wall you lean back on, that the body will always demand some attention. And it's a very interesting and useful exercise to understand this first hindrance, to actually notice the demands of the body, and just to notice your response to those demands, try to satisfy them. And when you do that reflection on the demands of the body and the need to be satisfied, you can just see how much space in the mind is taken up by the desire or the search for comfort in the physical body. It's not just scratching and itching, it's being fed, it's evacuating the bowels. It's sometimes, if you've got a stomachache, it's trying to get rid of that, and the amount of space that takes in the mind, the amount of thoughts connected with illness or disease or a lack of physical comfort, trying to get rid of it. And even in its more subtle forms, it is just that move of the head, it is just the fidgeting of the fingers. But that too, if you see closely, is the search for physical comfort in the body. Every movement which you make of the body is for the search for comfort. And when you just see how much time and effort that trying to find the comfort of the body takes, you can understand why this first hindrance is a great hindrance to peace and quiet. You're sitting comfortably and something itches. You're starting to get still and the mosquito starts buzzing around your ear. It doesn't land straight away, it goes buzz, 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 to disturb you to the maximum before it actually lands. And then you're waiting for it, just for the for it to start biting you. It sort of teases you, tantalizes you to the utmost. And you can start to see that the amount of disturbance trying to find comfort in the body actually gives. And the interesting thing about looking at the body in terms of the first hindrance is that how do you try and solve that problem of finding satisfaction, comfort in the body? Because you find that if you scratch that itch, if you push away that mosquito, it just comes back again. If you move that leg, there's another part of the body needs moving. If you try and overcome that first hindrance by following it and by giving in to its demands, then you find that it just creates more noise. This is the lie of that first hindrance. It's promising you, just scratch me and everything will be all right and comfortable. Just push the mosquito away and then no more will land on you. Just give me this pleasure, this comfort, and then I won't ask for any more. And that's the lie of the physical feelings. You satisfy one and two more come up to ask for your attention. And this is the same with trying to find pleasure in the external sensory world, whether it's a beautiful lunch, a beautiful dinner, a beautiful place to go and see, a beautiful garden where you live, a beautiful monastery where you hang out. Whatever it is, you find that if you give it some attention, it will ask for more. So the way to overcome that very disturbing first hindrance, which is seeking to satisfy the world of the five senses, is not by giving attention to it. It's not by going out there and trying to finish off the outstanding demands of the five senses. The only way you overcome that hindrance is to drop all your concern with the five senses. To drop all your concern with the body, say. Because if you just drop your concern with the body, if you're itchy, you can go on itching. I don't care. Mosquito, you can just go and bite as much as you want. Pain, you can just go on paining. I'm not paying attention. If you take away your attention from the body, only then does it stop its demands. Only then do you have a sense of peace and quiet from the demands of the body. And I think most of you would have experienced that by now. When you're meditating, if those demands of the body aren't too great at the beginning, you're not in great pain, or it's not too hot, not too cold, and you're in reasonable comfort, say, reasonable comfort, because there will still be some disturbances of the body which manifest as fidgets, scratches, coughs, or whatever. But if one doesn't pay attention to those and pays attention to the meditation object, such as the breath, if one puts enough sustained attention on the meditation object, the breath, then you find that the body quietens down and the scratches, the itches disappear, the sense of being too hot disappears. And the mosquitoes, they don't seem to bother you. Very often you don't even notice them. You find that this is the way that you overcome that first hindrance of concern for satisfaction, comfort, pleasure in the realm of the five senses. And then it's good to notice with the body that when you get into that position or that state, you know, what I describe as the body disappearing, the body hasn't disappeared, as everyone knows who is watching you, it's still there. But the experience of the body disappears. The sense of touch, a physical sensation of touch, the fifth sense, has turned off. And you're not concerned at all with the body. It's not calling you, it's not demanding anything. You don't even feel the body. The mind is connected to the breath. And just to notice that that is a great relief when you don't have to attend to the demands of the body. It's not hungry, it's not dirty, it doesn't want to go be taken to the toilet, it doesn't need to be scratched, it's not hurting, it's not there. And it's very useful to notice that when the body is taken away, it's like a burden has been taken away from you. It's one, when you say that one less thing to worry about, that's a bit of an understatement. It's many things you don't have to worry about. And being able to release the mind from the body is an indication of why that sense, the fifth sense, is called a hindrance. And it's not just the body, obviously. The sense of smell and taste is one of the two probably most minor senses. It's also the sense of sight and sound as well, wanting to find comfort there as well. When one is sitting meditation, one can close the eyes. It's very easy to shut off the sense of sight. However, one can imagine things, still trying to get some sort of pleasure and satisfaction through the sense of sight, its imaginary counterpart. However, perhaps one of the most disturbing of the senses next to the bodily sensation is sound as well. Trying to find comfort in the sense which is we call sound. And wherever you go and sit, there'll always be some sort of noise. Either someone's talking, or the frogs at the monastery are croaking too loud, or it's the crows making an awful sound, or it's somebody coming in and banging the door, it's the telephone ringing, it's something or other. That concern for all of those things is why it's a hindrance. If one doesn't concern oneself with sound, one just takes away one's interest, then the sound disappears. One doesn't hear it. It's why Ajahn Chah used to say that in meditation, it's not that sound disturbs you, it's that you disturb the sound. You go out there with your concern, interest, to try and find comfort with that sense base. And by going out, sending the mind out, then you are disturbing yourself. So the way to overcome this first hindrance of the search for sensory satisfaction in the external five senses, the way to overcome that is through disinterest. It's taking away the concern, the fascination, the interest for that realm. And that is a very difficult thing for a person to do. If you can do that, then you're halfway into the jhanas. To fully take away your concern. that concern very often manifests as control, control of the body, control of the other four senses. And here, it's not control which you're supposed to be doing, it's letting go, disinterest, dropping them, detaching yourself from them, separating the mind from the body. So the body just fades away, you're not interested. That which you're not interested in disappears. And the reason why that disturbance continues is because we're still interested. We still want to control this. We still want to be in charge of all this. And that's the first hindrance. If you can play around with this hindrance by noticing the body sense, I think you gain a lot of insight and wisdom into what this hindrance truly is. And it will give you the teaching that you cannot satisfy these senses. They're always demanding. If you do satisfy them, you satisfy them momentarily, and then they demand something else. Look at your body and you'll see that for yourself. And also notice that the way you overcome that hindrance is by taking away your attention. Next time your body disappears in meditation, just realize that the hindrance connected with that sense has been overcome. And what a freedom that is. You don't have to worry about the body. The Buddha described that hindrance as someone who is, this is from the point of view of wisdom, someone who's looking in a bowl of water to see their own reflection. In the time of the Buddha, they used to use bowls of water as a mirror. Sometimes they used to use highly polished pieces of metal, but they would not give such a good reflection, and they'd be only for wealthy people. And they were saying that if in that water there's beautiful dyes and colors, you become so fascinated with the beauty of those colors in the water that you do not see your own reflection. And if there is the karma chanda or abhijja there in the mind, if there is that concern for the realm of the five senses, then because of that concern, you do not see your own reflection. You do not see who you are. This is using this simile as the obstacle to wisdom arising. Your own reflection is who you are. And if there's concern for the five senses, then you're not looking at who you are. The mind is otherwise taken up. And that's the meaning of the Buddha's simile of a bowl of water, a person trying to look at their own reflection, and all they see is the colours. They just get entranced by those colours. Entranced by, they may not be beautiful enough, they want to be more beautiful. They may be already beautiful and they want to remain. It's all to do with entrancement, with concern, with making business with the world of the five senses. It's overcome through taking away the interest, through letting go, through a sense of distaste, a realization that this realm of the five senses cannot be satisfied, is a bit of a pain. You never really get what you want. If you do get what you want, it never lasts. And so after a while, one just actually literally gets fed up with it. One gets fed up with trying to make the body just comfortable. You forget what get fed up with scratching. You get fed up with trying to find the perfect place to sit in meditation where there's no sound, where it's got this silent air conditioner which is just the right temperature. I find if it's just the right temperature for me, it's not the right temperature for the monk sitting next to me, which is not the right temperature for someone else. Someone times in the monastery, when we're meditating, someone opens the windows and then someone gets up to close them because they don't want them open. And then someone goes to open them again. You can never please everybody. So you find that the only perfect place is when you let go of that five sensory realm. The second hindrance is the ill will. And usually that means the ill will towards somebody else. However, in the meditation is very rarely, especially like living with really nice people like we're doing this 9 days, it's very rarely that you get ill will towards a person. You get like hatred up and just thinking how you're going to disturb them or kill them or something. Maybe if you're in one of these retreat places where you have to share a room, the person next to you snores, you may be getting ill will towards them. But here, when you've got your own place and you've got beautiful food, and it's very hard, unlikely to get ill will. But if there is ill will there towards another person, there's no way you can be able to get peaceful in meditation or see any wisdom. The ill will be the hindrance. However, I want to dwell this morning on the ill will towards the meditation object, or even just the process of meditation. Because sometimes you find, especially towards the middle or the end of the meditation retreat, if you haven't got as many good results as you wanted, or even no good results, there comes a time when you start sitting down and watching the breath, and automatically ill will comes up towards that breath. Because you associate that breath with painful knees, with a painful back, with sitting down being too hot, with mosquitoes biting you, and the breath becomes a scapegoat for all this pain and difficulty and frustration which you're going through. And it's very easy for one to get into the habit of looking at the breath with ill will. And you grudgingly watch the breath as if you're being forced to do it. And sometimes you think you're forcing yourself to do it. You think it's for your own good. I've got to do this, but you're not really enjoying it. You have actually negativity towards the meditation object. Now, if you have negativity towards the meditation object, it's going to be very difficult, almost impossible, to watch that object, because the mind just wants to run away somewhere else. It just wants to go off and fantasize. It just wants to go off and dream. It even wants to go off and sleep, because its experiences so far have mistakenly generated ill will towards the meditation object. I can't watch the breath. And to some meditators, unfortunately even some monks who haven't had very good instructions in meditation, and they've got into meditation, they haven't got good results at the beginning, and they've got stuck. Every time that we do the meditation and they start meditating on the breath, aversion comes up to what they're doing straight away, and they get into this psychological dead end street. The aversion's coming up, and that just creates more aversion towards a meditation object. So to overcome that hindrance, the Buddha always said the main way of overcoming ill will is through developing loving kindness. And it's one of the reasons why I suggested, I think in a public talk, certainly I've suggested to people individually, that it is very helpful to develop loving kindness towards your meditation object. If it's the breath which you're watching, then to develop that sense of gratitude, thankfulness, care, even love towards the breath. That which you love, you find delight in. That which you find delight in, you just want to stay close to. And you find if you can develop a sense of gratitude, love, care, caressing the breath, make it even like sensual towards the breath, a sense of like, this is enjoyable, this is delightful, then you'll find the mind will be more able to go towards that breath, to find it, and to stay with it for a long period of time. So if you have difficulty following the breath, then look to see, is it because you have aversion, ill will towards that object? Is it because actually you don't want to stay with that breath? And that's why that you move away very quickly. If so, you'll find by developing loving kindness towards the breath, and it's not that hard to do, you'll find that the mind will lean towards the meditation object rather than leaning away. It will incline to it
So if you're not doing anything, it will go there by itself, rather than going away. But someone who's meditated for many years and has got good results, you notice the mind just wants to go towards the breath. You don't have to sort of push it and nudge it. It sees the breath, and the breath is like a really fine old friend. You've had such good times together in the past. You've enjoyed, being with the breath so much. But as soon as you see that old friend just walking down the street in the distance, you stop what you're doing and go towards it. And, you hang out with the breath because you've had good times together. So if you start to look upon the breath as the good old friend, especially if you had some good experiences in meditation using the breath, then the mind inclines towards the breath. You find it's easier to remain with the breath, to stay with the breath. It's not a question of you willing to stay with the breath. The mind leans, is attracted towards it. It's regarded as an old friend, someone you love very dearly. So to develop that love and kindness towards the breath, obviously if you have some good experiences, it occurs naturally. Another way of doing it is just developing the thoughts of loving kindness, care, compassion, and spreading that to the breath, to look upon the breath as a being, something which has nurtured you since you were very small, something which is still looking after you and caring for you, supplying you with oxygen, taking away all the used gases, and then giving you more oxygen afterwards. And it's done this all the time without rest, 24 hours a day. And you're just using some imagination. You're just changing an attitude, developing a perception. But after a while, you can develop the perception of great warmth and kindness and love towards the breath. And once that occurs, you can see that hindrance of ill will has been overcome, and the mind goes towards the breath. It goes towards that which it loves, that which it delights in. And the hindrance has been overcome. So that is the hindrance of ill will. The Buddha described it as trying to see your face in boiling water. And boiling water, not only is it bubbling, it's stirring up the mind, but also because of the heat of the water, it pushes the face away. You don't want to get scalded. It repels the mind. So the boiling water repels the face. You're looking over it to try and see your reflection, but the steam or the splattering of hot water pushes you away. You can't stay looking close to that boiling water. And that's the simile there of ill will. Ill will means you cannot stay with your chosen object. There's a repelling force there. And even though that you want to, you will, you find you cannot do it. So if you cannot stay with the meditation object, check. Is there ill will towards that object? And try developing loving kindness towards it and see if that works. The third hindrance of Tina Mida, the sloth and torpor, is one of the most difficult hindrances to overcome. It's only fully overcome by the Arahat. Even the non-returner, the Anagami, still has sloth and torpor. And so that's why it's very hard to overcome this one. Again, it is the state of mind where you go into dullness. One way of overcoming that is to realize, through some degree of reflection. Reflection is hard in sloth and torpor because the mind is all misty and muddy and unclear. But if you can just reflect on, what does this feel like? Is this fun? Is this enjoyable? Because very often the states of sloth and torpor is actually a very unpleasant state to be in. You're half there, you're half not there. But that half which is there isn't having fun. Being dull. It's not, if you're asleep and they're fully dull, fully knocked out, then at least there's no pain there.
but you know, having to sit here, not really being fully awake, it's not a very pleasant state to be in. And the more you can notice that sloth and torpor isn't fun, is pain, then the more incentive there will be to develop that energy to avoid this at all costs. And the usual way of avoiding sloth and torpor is to catch it before it establishes itself in your mind. Because once sloth and torpor is there, it's just well established, it's so hard to eradicate. You know, once you're really sleepy, in a monastery in Thailand, when we're doing the all-night sitting, sometimes we do some stupid things to try and overcome sloth and torpor. You know, we do walking meditation backwards, you know, in the hall. So if you're walking meditation, and you think like the fear of banging yourself into the wall would stop you, but no, it didn't. You just walked backwards and straight into the wall. It goes back to sloth, you're just so dull. You just you do not know what you're doing. And monks would use all sorts of tricks to try and overcome sloth and torpor, but it's almost impossible to overcome that sloth and torpor. You may remember one of the tricks which was common in Thailand, which I tried to do, was just to take a matchbox. And you may try that in the morning if you wish to do the overcome sloth and torpor. You take the lid off, and with the matchbox with lots of matches in, the more matches the better, you put it on top of your head when you meditate. Because, you know, when you get sleepy, the head goes down and all the matches go on the floor and everyone hears it. And you have to go and pick them all up again, and that's sort of, you know, a bit of a bind. So you can try that in the morning. I don't know if you've got enough matchboxes here, but trouble is that when I did this in Thailand, it used to fall on the floor in the middle of the meeting, so everyone knew it. But when you have to pick them all up again and do it again. But after a while, I overcame the problem. And I thought I wasn't nodding anymore. I thought I was full awake. And I found out actually what I was doing. Someone told me that when I was sitting, I was nodding like this. You And it's, the mind is amazing, just what it does. And I've seen other monks do that as well, so I believe them. That's what I was actually doing. So when you actually you do get into sloth and torpor, it's very difficult to get out of. The best way of overcoming that obstacle is by developing enough mindfulness, you start to see the sloth and torpor creeping up on you and overwhelming your mind. You start to notice how it comes and how it establishes itself. Because when it's coming through the door, that's the time you can push it out and close the door quickly. Once it's got in, there's no way you're going to get it out easily. That's why usually at the beginning of a meditation, that's the time when you have to overcome sloth and torpor. You do that by just arousing more energy, strengthening the mindfulness, putting more effort into what you're doing. Instead of just watching the breath going in, breath going out, you really watch it as if it's something very, very important to you. You put more energy in. Energy is something which is there all the time. I mentioned this before. No matter how sleepy and tired you are, if your house is on fire, you wake up straight away. If a snake comes into the room, everyone is alert. If someone comes in with a knife or a machete, mad and crazy and wanting to kill the Buddhists, then you wake up, you've got energy, you're fully alert. So the energy is in there all the time. It's just like turning it on. And turning it on means just finding those continuous actions, those series of switches to get the mind going, to turn it on. Because sloth and torpor happens most commonly early in the morning, it's the way one gets up in the morning is so important. When the alarm goes, when you hear the bell, you don't go and think, well, I'm not supposed to be out till 4:30, I've got another 25 minutes. Well, you don't think walking meditation, nobody knows if I'm going to be walking or not. And have an extra 55 minutes. Because you find that then you really sort of, you started the day on the wrong way. Trust yourself that if you've had, 4 or 5 hours sleep, that's enough. Get up immediately. Just jump up off the bed and splash water on your face. Do very strong and physical movements. You find that the mind starts to wake up. And the blood starts to course through you. And you feel good. Especially if you can, say, beat the bell in the morning and get up 5 minutes before it. Or beat your alarm clock. If you set the alarm clock at 4 o'clock, always try and get up 5 minutes before. Because that makes you feel that, you're in control rather than this alarm clock. You're not like one of these Pavlovian dogs. When the bell goes, then you do something. And it makes you feel energetic, in control. And to keep wary of that sloth and torpor creeping up during the day. So you maintain that energy going. Sloth and torpor, the Buddha described as like the bowl is just covered with like moss and algae, which has just grown there because the water hasn't moved for days, for years. Because there's been no effort, no energy put into the mind or the body. And after a while, if you don't put effort and energy into the mind and body, this moss, this algae, just slowly grows over it and covers it. And all you need to do to get rid of the algae or the moss is just to sweep it aside, to agitate the water. And if the mind is always working, then the algae never has a chance to establish itself in the mind. The algae is the sloth and torpor. And when you look into that water, instead of seeing your face, you just see this green mucky slime, which is the sloth and torpor. So that's that, the sloth and torpor, which is a difficult one to overcome, but you can't get into peaceful states of into deep states of concentration when you've got sloth and torpor. And after a while you realize you're wasting your time. And it's an unpleasant waste of time as well. The fourth hindrance is restlessness and remorse. I already mentioned that remorse is a sense of guilt which comes up if one has done something wrong. And very often that can come up in one's meditation retreats. For some reason or another, you're sitting there and you remember something which you've done in the past, which you're upset about. And the way to overcome remorse, as everyone knows, is forgiveness. Just to understand that if you've done something wrong which you feel guilty about, one, you're a human being, you're not an arahat yet, you're not perfect yet, so you will make mistakes. So understand that this is natural for a human being to make such mistakes, to be imperfect. So it gives you the opening to forgive yourself, and then just take that jump of forgiving yourself, understanding that if you forgive yourself, you're more likely not to do the same thing again. Through forgiveness, there is growth. Through understanding what one has done and taking responsibility for it and not carrying it around with you, you're more likely not to do the same thing again. So understanding that, one, that you are a human being and you do make mistakes, and what can you expect? And number two, that the way to improve in the future is not by burdening yourself with that guilt, but by through forgiving it, forgiving yourself. Through forgiving yourself, you don't create such bad deeds in the future, and you become more concerned with your practice of virtue, your goodness, your harmlessness towards the beings in this world, and you find that that hindrance doesn't come up at all. So the remorse is overcome if one is virtuous,
if one hasn't been virtuous, then what to expect? You're human beings, you're not heavenly beings. And as such, you will make mistakes now and again. If remorse comes up, if guilt, some thought of the past, forgive yourself. If you can't forgive yourself, then go to someone you trust and say that this is what I've done in the past. You know, just telling someone else really helps you forgive yourself. Because by telling someone else, that the other person, we always say, well, big deal, so what? You should listen to what I've done. And if you can't tell someone else, then even that using a skillful means, you know, just come here and just tell the Buddha, the statue over here. And I guarantee I haven't got a tape recorder hidden underneath it. It's not going to be recorded. But just like telling someone, telling even the Buddha, means that you're also at the same time telling yourself. And you can just forgive. With forgivingness, there is letting go of the burden. And alongside that hindrance of the remorse for a deed badly done is the restlessness of the mind. And I always was mentioning at the moment, first of all, that restlessness is very closely associated with the first hindrance, and also the second hindrance as well, of ill will. Because restlessness is the refusal to stay in one place. And that's either because one has been drawn away by the promise of happiness or contentment somewhere else, which is called desire, or one is dissatisfied with the present moment, with what you've got, and that pushes you away, and that's called aversion. And you can usually see that this restlessness is caused by either the pull to something else which you haven't got, or the dissatisfaction with what you have got at the moment. And that is overcome by regarding what you have got in a more wise light. If you're watching the breath, then to regard that breath is going to be the road into peacefulness for you. So you develop that loving kindness towards the breath, which makes you content to be with the breath. The patience to give yourself enough time to develop these samadhi states so you don't rush and have negativity because you're not getting as far as you want to get as quickly as you want. Now the impatience will be a cause for negativity towards where you're at, the state where you are. And after a while, the restlessness is overcome by this just letting things be and finding actually that where you are is quite satisfactory. Now, you're doing okay. Now, this process will work by itself in its own time. So you be patient with it. You just do the instructions and leave it there. You don't get this restlessness that I've got to achieve today, I've got to get here. Now this meditation right now, I'm sure everyone else is getting into these jhanas. I noticed someone coming in today, they had a nice smile on their face. It's just really, why is it them and not me? So be patient, and then maybe you won't have so much restlessness. And see that also as something which creeps up on the mind and establishes itself. It starts off just with a little bit of agitation. You can build up with, you just can't find any place to sort of sit down, as it were, inside and find some peace and contentment. One is always running away. It's Ajahn Chah's favourite story, which was actually from the Buddha, of the dog with mange. The dog with mange goes out into the sun and it still itches. So it goes out into the shade and it still itches. It goes into the water and it itches. It rubs itself in the dirt, it still itches. It goes into a cave, it still itches. Wherever it goes, it itches. Because the itch is with the dog. And that's restlessness. We go away, run here, run there, run all over the place to try and get rid of this itch, this irritation. And you find that the restlessness doesn't get rid of the irritation at all, but very often just makes it worse. So the irritation is not with the place where you are, it's with your attitude to the place you are. And after a while you develop the you develop the attitude of loving kindness towards the breath, the dispassion towards the world of the five senses, and you find that you can stay where you are and restlessness disappears and tranquility arises in its place. The opposite of restlessness is tranquility, settling down. Actually, tranquility is the natural state of the mind. If you leave it alone, it settles down. Ajahn Chah used to describe it like a leaf in the forest. Its natural state is to be still. It's only if someone shakes a tree or if a wind blows that it starts to vibrate and becomes restless. Once the wind disappears, once the person stops shaking the tree, then the leaf stops moving after a while. Restlessness disappears. So if you keep the attention on the breath and stop shaking the tree, then after a while everything settles down and one realizes tranquility. And that's actually the simile the Buddha used, using the a bowl of water when its surface is whipped up by the wind, the winds of desire and aversion. Once that wind disappears, the waves on the surface disappear, and then you can see your face. When you've got restlessness, your image is distorted. You can't really see truly what's going on. You can get flashes of your image on the vibrating surface of the water, but only flashes, and that's just what restlessness. Maybe a moment you see, and then it's all gone again. So restlessness is the hindrance which stops you seeing reality and also which obscures the peaceful mind. And the last hindrance is doubt. And that doubt, the main part of that doubt which I'm pointing out to at the moment today is that self-doubt, the doubt in one's own ability to do this. If you believe you can do this, you're halfway to achieving it. If you think you can't, then there's no way. And it's a strange thing that a lot of times we think this is beyond us, this is beyond us, this is beyond us. I've been trying for 1 week and still haven't got enlightened yet. Sometimes that because of that doubt, we will not be able to do anything. So to overcome that doubt, it's always through faith, through confidence, through trust in oneself. That trust is engendered if one gets small minor successes. If one can find what I can do, at least like the first stage of meditation. Well, I can do this. Maybe I can now do the second. Getting the second. Well, I've done this. Maybe I can do something more. The faith and confidence in oneself. That faith and confidence is also engendered by one's knowledge of the Buddha's teachings, where the Buddha said that you can do this, and where you find other people who are much, much worse off than you are able to concentrate the mind and become, you know, fully enlightened. Even like we've got this idea these days in the Western world, if you've had some terrible trauma in your childhood, then there's no way that you can become enlightened. That, you know, you've got some sort of psychological block. And think of the trauma of, like, the mass murderer Angulimala having killed, I don't know, 999 people. And he managed to get enlightened without any counselling. And there was also Rahula, whose father ran away when he was born. He didn't have a father. Poor old Rahula, he managed to get enlightened. There was also someone called Gotama, whose mother died when he was only 7 days old, and he managed to get fully enlightened, become the Buddha. And there's so many other stories, like people who had very difficult times. You know, people, you know, who were prostitutes, and they weren't high-level prostitutes. They just got into this just out of being in a poverty trap, who became fully enlightened nuns.
And you got also one person who, she lost her husband. I forget the whole story now. It was Patachari, yes. And she lost her husband, and she was going with her two kids or three kids crossing the stream. One of them died, one got taken up by a hawk, and the third one also died. And just in that 24 hours, she'd lost her husband and her three kids, and she was so distraught that she actually came into the Jeta Grove in the middle of a discourse by the Buddha, completely naked. And she was just crazy with what had happened to her. And she became enlightened eventually as well. So, if these people can do it, and these are people who have had really difficult traumas, then we can do it as well. So, little stories like that gives you faith that all it's possible for all people to gain these states of mind. And that faith is enormously important. It's one of the reasons why people do not achieve is because they believe they can't. And you keep on bashing away at the same point, you can, and you find they do. So that doubt is a terrible hindrance if it comes up. It's also the doubt about what should you be doing. And it's the job of the teacher to make it quite clear what the path is, what you should be doing, how you should do it, giving you not too many instructions, but clear instructions on the path to meditation. So, you know, I do this, then I do that, then I do this, then I do that. If this obstacle comes up, this is what I should do. And if you get sort of clear teachings, that will overcome doubt. You know what you're doing, you know where you are, you know what you should do next. So these are the five hindrances. If you recognize any of these as great obstacles in your meditation, that's very good, because recognition is the first step to overcoming. During your meditation, if any of these obstacles come up, or if an obstacle comes up and you it creates a barrier for you, check five hindrances. Which one is it? Or which combination is it? And knowing what the obstacle is, knowing its name, then you start to remember the antidotes to it. Oh, it's aversion, it's ill will. Let's develop some loving kindness, or loving kindness towards the object. So if it's ill will towards myself, a sense of self-hatred that I don't deserve to achieve this, then loving kindness towards yourself. If you see the cause for the obstacle, then you've got a good chance of overcoming it. And that way, your progress in meditation will be smooth and successful. So this is the talk on the five hindrances. I didn't mention, sorry, the last hindrance of doubt. The Buddha, he called it like the muddy water, which is so sort of full of mud and things that you cannot sort of see your own reflection. Like doubt gives you these all sorts of other things to think about. So instead of actually seeing your reflection, you're thinking, should I do this, should I do that, what does this mean, what's the consequence of this, why? And all that sort of doubt just takes up too much time. So you're looking at the mud. No, it's not really beautiful like the colours in the water of the first instances. You're looking like the mud in the water instead of looking at the reflection. It's wasting time. So those are the five hindrances and ways to overcome them. So has anyone got any questions about the five hindrances? Yeah.
In the
area,
is there a point, a turning point, when these hindrances actually disappear and become centered? Or is there a space to push back?
You're asking about when the hindrances disappear. The hindrances disappear temporarily whenever one gets close to a jhana. And it's the meaning of a jhana is the absence of the five hindrances. The absence of the five hindrances frees the mind, especially the first one, which frees the mind from the concern of the body and the external five senses. These external five senses are switched off when the first hindrance finally disappears. And you're just with the mind. It's like a great relief. And the more one notices that relief, the more those five hindrances get fully abandoned, not just abandoned and they sort of pop up again, and then they abandon again, they pop up again, but like fully abandoned, then that's the measure of a stable jhana state. So the jhana is the abandonment of the five hindrances fully. And also the post-jhana, the upachara samadhi, the five hindrances are still abandoned. They're only abandoned completely, sort of when one attains any of the enlightenment experiences. And as I mentioned, that something like Tinamita, the sloth and torpor, is only abandoned, you know, when one fully attains enlightenment. Even some of the great meditating monks, there are times when they just get sleepy. You know, the body becomes so heavy, and just the mind just misses it and gets caught up in the tiredness and the sloth and the dullness. So that's the most difficult one to overcome, along with maybe like restlessness, because there's a certain restlessness of the mind which even the anagamis have as well. The sense, the concern for the world of the five senses, the first hindrance, and ill will is overcome by the non-returner. And the doubt is overcome by the sotapanna, the stream entry. So the more one progresses on the path, the more the obstacles or the hindrances are eliminated. And so for the stream enterer, it's easier to gain jhana. For the non-returner, it's a doddle to attain jhana. For the arahat, you can't avoid it because there's no obstacles left. So the hindrances are overcome fully only with the attainments of these deep insights, the enlightenment experiences. But in the meantime, they're overcome temporarily. And I did not mention that the purpose of eliminating these five hindrances to gain deep insight. The major insights which give rise to enlightenment is either insight into the depth of impermanence, which gives rise to the understanding of anatta, of non-self. The experience which gives rise to enlightenment is understanding anatta, non-self. That's the crucial one. Impermanence and suffering almost like byproducts of that. Or another way of looking at it, the understanding of anatta is just the direct consequence of understanding impermanence and dukkha. However, it's the understanding of anatta which gives rise to the full enlightenment. And you can understand why the Buddha was mentioning the similes of the five hindrances, not being able to see your own reflection in these bowls of water. You're not able to see who you truly are, or more accurately, who you are not, when the five hindrances are present. So the five hindrances are what stops you fully seeing anatta. So the path of Buddhism comes to be finding ways to suppress these five hindrances so you can see anatta, so that the five hindrances get fully abandoned. The hard thing is just to suppress them temporarily, long enough, powerfully enough, that you can look into that clear bowl and see your own reflection. That's one of the suttas that Ananda said, that all the Buddhas in the all the enlightened ones in the past, all the enlightened ones now, all the enlightened ones in the future, become enlightened through abandoning the five hindrances. He just said that much. It's such a crucial part of the path of enlightenment. Yeah? Indeed, like strong faith can overcome hindrances very powerfully. It can that's one of the good things about faith. It can also get you into all sorts of troubles and messes as well. But strong faith can certainly can get you into a deep meditation state because it overcomes the hindrances. You've got so much trust in your teacher or in your guru. And even though I have not too much experience of other teachings or other methods, I expect, I wouldn't be surprised if some, say, of the Hindu gurus managed to incite these very blissful experiences in their disciples through that power of faith, through generating that trust and confidence in their disciples. So they've got so much confidence and faith that, you know, that they don't even consider any of the hindrances. And the mind is so soft and so sort of willing to embrace, they can embrace the meditation object straight away and stay with it. The power of faith can do that, but it can also not just embrace the good things, it can embrace some stupid things as well. That's why faith is dangerous. So it's certainly powerful.
Some of you use methods like devotional singing, for instance, as a way of arousing faith. Why doesn't Buddhism look at...
We do do that. We have morning chanting. Devotional singing.
I mean, there are techniques that they use which concentrate on devotion and faith.
There are, yeah.
And arousing that, which just aren't there in Buddhism.
You're asking that some Hindu teachers or other teachers, they do devotional singing and thereby they arouse devotional faith. You say that's not done in Buddhism. That is actually done in Buddhism, but it's something which hasn't really carried over yet into Western Buddhism. You know, we started doing some chanting and there's other devotional practices which are done in Buddhism. And eventually that, you know, even like things like us bowing is a devotional practice. And those devotional practices will eventually come in. It's just they haven't fully come in yet. But if one ever goes to like an Asian country, you see many, many devotional practices. And some of them have danger, so you've got to be careful. But now some of the chanting, you know, we're not very good chanters here, we don't do very much. But sometimes some of the chanting which I've heard in Thailand, especially by the nuns, it's gorgeous. You can listen to it for hours. Well, some of the Sri Lankan monks are very beautiful chanters. You know, we've got a tape of Venerable Piyadasi and it just sounds so soothing and peaceful. You just, you know, listen to that and you just, you know, go all gooey inside. So there are some of those, and I take your point. I think they should be introduced more and more later on, at the right time, in the right place.
Yeah, from the
not fully, because it doesn't go fully away from the tradition, because the Buddha did praise faith once it is balanced with wisdom. And it is... opening up the emotional side of the human being, which is, as I was saying, very important to attain a jhana. The rational side is also important, and that's like the faith side. So that's the panya side, the wisdom side. But the faith is also very important. Like, you know, if you're as a monk with someone like Ajahn Chah, and he was one of these beings who would arouse faith and confidence, and he would tell you to do something, and it didn't make any sense at all. If you thought about it, this was ridiculous. But you know, you did it out of faith and you found it worked. It was only because you trusted him, you had that faith in him, that you allowed yourself to do that. Otherwise, you'd still be, you know, arguing the merits or the demerits of doing that. Yeah, you're saying singing tends to carry the mind away, yeah. But some of the chanting is can be very, very beautiful and very devotional. And if it's done very well, and it can be really inspire one. And you know, some of that beautiful chanting, you know, I think could be developed more. Maybe send the monks down to get some voice training.
But the more you change in religion,
the more you lose.
So you should be able to change in religion, the more you get away from the
yes, indeed. The more you change it, the usually it's changing from the worst. And but this isn't changing. This is using something which has been in Buddhism for many centuries. In Thailand, that sometimes used to have morning chanting every morning, evening chanting every evening, used to last about an hour. And on the moon days, used to have the evening chanting. All the villagers would come and all chant together. And sometimes it would be very inspiring. Sometimes it would be chronically depressing. But it's only because this is like, you know, a very poor part of Thailand where, you know, people were really coarse and rough and no one could really chant. So, you know, everyone tried their best. It wasn't like a refined part of the world where people had some appreciation of, like, things like tone and pitch.
And then the chanting tone, sort of really very well, sort of
melodic, isn't it? Yeah. I know that sometimes it's interesting. If you're right in the middle of the chanting, you know, you're actually participating in it. It doesn't usually sound so good. But if you just stand outside and you listen to it, it sounds beautiful. Because I know a few times that I've always thought that our monks are really terrible chanters. And then I've walked outside because I've had to leave for some reason or another. And it sounds beautiful. Yes? Yes. Yes, that's right. You have in Sri Lanka continuous 7-day chanting, and that's very tiring for the poor monks. They change, aren't they? But yeah, then that happens as well. And sometimes, if it's beautiful chanting, it can actually give being great sort of happiness and joy inside.
Yeah.
That's the one way of overcoming that when it's really hot, say at 2 o'clock, is bring your blankets and wrap them around you. This is what Ajahn Chah used to teach, sort of to make it really uncomfortable. And after the meal, when I first went to Wat Bapong, he had this little practice after the meal, one meal a day of sticky rice in the hot season. So, you know, you had this really heavy meal inside of you, and it was really, really hot and humid. And of course, you just wanted to go and crash out. No, you couldn't do that. As soon as your bowl was finished being washed, you went into this room about half the size of this, with about, how many monks, maybe 50 monks in, and had a tin roof lower than this. All the windows were shut. You had to wear your two robes. So you've got this rope here and the spare robe, which is double thickness. And you could bring extra blankets if you wanted to. No fans. And you, all these monks in the room, you know, sitting close together, boiling hot after the meal. And you had to put all these clothes on and meditate for 2 hours. It wasn't a sauna. The sauna could take your clothes off. And the purpose of this was that it was so unpleasant to get dull.
the only escape was to overcome sloth and torpor and to get into some sort of samadhi. So you were pushed. You had to develop energy. Otherwise, you're just too much suffering. So you can push yourself sometimes that way. Right, don't take the easy way, because sloth and torpor always takes the easy way. The leaning against the wall, sort of, you know, leaning on the floor, sort of, you know, you drooping yourself, because it's easy to droop when you get low and low and low. So go against that movement of sloth and torpor to always take the easy way and take a harder way, and you find that generates energy. But don't sit where it's comfortable. And sit where it's a little bit hard or painful. Sit outside on the ground. Yeah? Sorry? The Tibetan tradition of sitting out in the snow. Hitting. Oh, that's the Zen tradition of hitting you if you start to go sleepy. That also works. I remember going into when I was a lay person in England, going to one of the Zen monasteries in the north of England. And you all sat against a wall, so you couldn't see this guy coming behind you with the Zen stick. And that was like the first time I'd been in such a retreat, a weekend retreat. And first thing in the morning, everyone was sleepy. But fortunately for me, the guy sitting next to me was more sleepy than I was. So he's the one who got clobbered. But as soon as one person got clobbered, everyone else woke up. It's amazing how alert I was afterwards.
Maybe it was just
your
passion
pretending to be sleeping. Yes, I was very good anyway, I don't know. But certainly that fear can do wonders for sloth and torpor. Anyway, I think that's enough now.